this as a hypothetical situation. Imagine that this is happening, and not as fact. He did so, after which Judge Older instructed the jury. They left the courtroom at 5:25 p.m. on Friday, March 26, 1971. While I felt confident that the jury would return a death penalty verdict against Charles Manson, I was less sure when it came to the girls. Only four females had been executed in California history, none of them as young as the defendants. I had anticipated that the jury would be out at least 4 days. When I received the call Monday afternoon after only 2 days, I knew there could be only one verdict. It was too fast for anything else. Their actual deliberations, I later learned, had taken only 10 hours. Again, under extraordinary security precautions, the jury was brought back into the courtroom at 4:24 p.m. on Monday, March 29th, with their verdicts. Manson and the girls had been brought into the courtroom earlier, the three female defendants now, when it was too late to influence the jury, having shaved their heads also. But before the clerk could read the first verdict, Manson yelled, "I don't see how you can get by with this without letting me put on some kind of defense. You people have no authority over me. Half of you in here ain't as good as I am." And Older ordered him removed. Manson's no-defense claim was nonsense. It was obvious that the defense he intended to put on during the guilt phase had been delivered in toto during the penalty phase. The jury's reaction to it was now being delivered, in a courtroom jammed with spectators and press. The clerk read the first verdict. "We, the jury in the above-entitled action, having found the defendant Charles Manson guilty of murder in the first degree as charged in count one of the indictment, do now fix the penalty as death." Krenwinkle: "You have just judged yourselves." Atkins: "Better lock your doors and watch your own kids." Van Houten: "Your whole system is a game. You blind, stupid people. Your children will turn against you." Judge Older had the three girls removed. They too listened over the loudspeaker as the clerk fixed the penalty for all four defendants as death on all counts. Judge Older left the bench to shake hands with each juror. "If it were within the power of a trial judge to award a Medal of Honor to jurors," he told them, "believe me, I would bestow an award on each of you." For the first time, the jurors could speak to the press about their ordeal. Jury foreman Herman Tubick told reporters that the jury was convinced the motive was helter-skelter. Mrs. Thelma McKenzie said the jury had certainly tried to find points upon which they could sentence the female defendants to a verdict less severe, but we couldn't. William McBride remarked, "I felt sympathy for the women, but sympathy can't interfere with justice. What they did deserves the death penalty." Marie Mesmer said she felt more pity for Susan Atkins than for the other two girls because of her background, but that she was shocked when all three showed no signs of remorse. As for Manson, she said, "I wanted to protect society. I think Manson is a very dangerous influence." Jean Roseland, mother of three teenagers, two of them girls, said the most terrible part of the whole trial was Leslie Van Houten looking at me with those big brown eyes. Mrs. Roseland was convinced Manson's power to manipulate others came not from within himself, but from the voids within the minds and souls of his followers. Later, Life ran an article entitled "The Manson Jury, End of a Long Ordeal." Ironically, there appeared in the same issue an article entitled "Paul McCartney on the Beatles' Breakup." That there had been irreconcilable troubles within the group became apparent, McCartney said, while they were making the White Album. Colonel Paul Tate was reported to have said regarding the death sentence verdicts, "That's what we wanted. That's what we expected. But there's no jubilation in something like this. No sense of satisfaction. It's more a feeling that justice has been done. Naturally, I wanted the death penalty. They took my daughter and my grandchild." Mrs. Tate told reporters that she didn't believe any human being should have the power to take a life, that that was up to God. Roman Polanski declined comment, as did the other relatives of the victims whom the media contacted. Sandy, Kathy, and the other girls on the corner had threatened to burn themselves to death with gasoline if any of the four were given death sentences. They didn't carry out their threat, though all did later shave their heads. On learning of the decision, Sandy looked into the TV cameras and screamed, "Death? That's what you're all going to get." With the exception of the sentencing, the trial was over. It had been the longest murder trial in American history, lasting 9.5 months, the most expensive, costing approximately $1 million, and the most highly publicized. While the jury had been sequestered 225 days, longer than any jury before it. The trial transcript alone ran to 209 volumes, 31,716 pages, approximately 8 million words, a mini library. For almost everyone, the ordeal was not only long but expensive. A number of the jurors, anticipating that they would be paid by their employers, now found themselves either unpaid or without jobs. Mrs. Roseland, for example, claimed that TWA did not honor a verbal agreement to keep her on salary until the end of the trial, and estimated she lost about $2,700 in back pay. TWA denied there was any such agreement. There were several such denials. The financial sacrifice on the part of the defense attorneys was enormous. Fitzgerald said, "It's just really wiped me out." He told a reporter that he had lost about $30,000 in income and incurred $10,000 in trial expenses. He had been forced to sell his stereo and other possessions and had spent $5,000 which he didn't have. Six times married Day Shin said, "I'm behind in my house payments and child support and my alimonies." Shin had received $19,000 in royalties from the Atkins book, he said, but he claimed that about $16,000 of it went back to the Manson family. Kenrick refused to discuss his financial situation. Another of the defense attorneys did tell me, however, that at one point during the trial Manson had ordered Shin to give Kenrick $5,000 from the Atkins account to help defray his expenses, but how much more he received, if any, is unknown. Keith, who received a fee from the county since he was court-appointed, admitted his private practice had gone downhill and that he didn't expect to gain any new clients as a result of the publicity. The trial cost another attorney his life. In the avalanche of stories on the Manson verdict, one small item which appeared that same day went almost unnoticed. The Ventura County Sheriff's Office reported that they had found a body believed to be that of the missing defense attorney, Ronald Hughes. The badly decomposed corpse had been found face down, wedged between two boulders in Sespe Creek, miles from where Hughes had last been seen alive. Two fishermen had discovered the body early Saturday, but didn't report it until Sunday night because we didn't want to spoil our fishing trip. The cause of death was, at this time, unknown. Through our office, I ordered an immediate autopsy. April 19th, 1971. Judge Older had set Monday, April 19th, 1971, as the date of sentencing. There was speculation that Older might decide on his own to reduce at least some of the verdicts from death to life. In a previous case, Older had done this for a defendant who had poured gasoline on two beds where four children were sleeping, killing one of them. However, I personally felt that since Older had complimented the jurors, he wouldn't turn right around and set aside their verdict. On the 19th, the court heard and rejected a number of defense motions, including those for a new trial. Judge Older then asked the defendants if they had anything to say. Only Manson did. Charlie's left hand was trembling, and he seemed near tears. Very meekly, with a quivering voice, he said, "I accept this court as my father. I have always done my best in my life to uphold the laws of my father, and I accept my father's judgment." The court. After 9.5 months of trial, all of the superlatives had been used, all of the hyperbole has been indulged in, and all that remains are the bare, stark facts of 7 senseless murders, 7 people whose lives were snuffed out by total strangers. I have carefully looked, in considering this action, for mitigating circumstances, and I have been unable to find any. It is my considered judgment that not only is the death penalty appropriate, but it is almost compelled by the circumstances. I must agree with the prosecutor that if this is not a proper case for the death penalty, what would be? Speaking to Manson, Judge Older said, "The Department of Corrections is ordered to deliver you to the custody of the warden of the state prison of the state of California at San Quentin, to be by him put to death in the manner prescribed by law of the state of California." There was at this time no death row for women. A special isolation wing was being constructed at the California Institute for Women at Frontera, and Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten were sent there to await execution. It was anticipated that the appeals would take at least 2 and possibly as long as 5 years. In actuality, their fate would be decided in less than 1. After the sentencing, I didn't anticipate ever seeing Charles Manson again. But I'd see him twice more, the last time under very peculiar circumstances. Epilogue. A Shared Madness. A more comprehensive description of her condition will necessitate further study, but at this time we might suggest the possibility that she may be suffering from a condition of folie à famille, a kind of shared madness within a group situation. Dr. Joel Hochman, in his psychiatric report on Susan Atkins. I lived with Charlie for 1 year straight and on and off for 2 years. I know Charlie. I know him inside and out. I became Charlie. Everything I once was Charlie. There was nothing left of me anymore. And all of the people in the family, there's nothing left of them anymore. They're all Charlie, too. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film Manson, Paul Watkins. We are what you have made us. We were brought up on your TV. We were brought up watching Gunsmoke, Have Gun, Will Travel, FBI, Combat. Combat was my favorite show. I never missed Combat. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film Manson, Brenda. Whatever is necessary, you do it. When somebody needs to be killed, there's no wrong. You do it, and then you move on. And you pick up a child, and you move him to the desert. You pick up as many children as you can, and you kill whoever gets in your way. That is us. From the Robert Hendrickson documentary film, Manson, Sandy. If you find an apple that has a little spot on it, you cut out that spot. Squeaky. You just better hope I never get out. Bobby Beausoleil. A Shared Madness. Although Manson and the girls had been convicted, the trials and the murders were not yet over. For their part in the attempted murder of prosecution witness Barbara Hoyt, 4 of the 5 defendants served 90 days in the county jail, while the 5th escaped punishment entirely. Although I was not assigned to the case, I questioned the way it was handled. Because it was felt that the evidence against the defendants was weak, and because of the expense of flying in witnesses from Hawaii, the DA's office, LAPD, and the defense attorneys agreed to a deal. In return for the defendants pleading no contest to 1 count of conspiracy to dissuade a witness from testifying, the prosecutor made a motion to reduce the charge from a felony to a misdemeanor. Judge Stephen Stothers granted the motion, and on April 16, 1971, he sentenced 4 of the 5 defendants, Lynette Frome, a.k.a. Squeaky, Steve Grogan, a.k.a. Clem, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, and Dennis Rice, to 90 days in the county jail. Since they had already served 15 days, They were back on the streets in 75 days. The fifth defendant, Ruth Ann Morehouse, a.k.a. Uish, the girl who actually gave Barbara Hoyt the LSD-laden hamburger, got off scot-free. When it came time for sentencing, she failed to appear. Although a bench warrant was issued for her arrest and she was known to be living in Carson City, Nevada, the DA's office decided it wasn't worth the trouble to extradite her. Charles Tex Watson went on trial in August 1971. A good portion of my preparation took place not in a law library, but in a medical library, since I was relatively sure that Watson was going to plead not guilty by reason of insanity and put on a psychiatric defense. The trial had three possible phases: guilt, sanity, and penalty, each of which presented its own special problems. Even though defense attorney Sam Bubrick told me that Watson intended to take the stand and confess, I knew I still had to present a strong case during the guilt phase, since it was a safe bet that Watson's testimony would be self-serving. Two, I had to prove, by evidence such as Watson's instructing Linda to steal the $5,000, that although Watson was dominated by Manson, he still had enough independence to make him legally responsible for his acts. One of the key issues during the guilt trial, then, was whether Watson was suffering from diminished mental capacity at the time of the murders. If he was, and it was of such a nature that it prevented him from deliberating and premeditating, the jury would have to find the chief Tate LaBianca killer guilty of second rather than first-degree murder. If convicted of any degree of criminal homicide, then there would be a sanity trial, in which the sole issue would be whether Watson was sane or insane at the time of the murders. I anticipated, and quite rightly, that the defense would call a number of prominent psychiatrists. Eight were called, many of whom would testify that, in their opinion, Watson was insane. Therefore, I'd not only have to subject their testimony to withering cross-examination, I'd also have to present an abundance of evidence showing that Watson was in full command of his mental faculties at the time of the murders, and that he was well aware that in the eyes of society what he was doing was wrong. In short, I had to prove that he wasn't legally insane. Such evidence as his cutting of the telephone wires, his telling Linda to wipe the knives of fingerprints, his manner when talking to Rudolph Weber, and his using an alias when questioned by the authorities in Death Valley a few weeks after the murders, thus became extremely important to proving my case, in that all were circumstantial evidence of a consciousness of wrongdoing and guilt on Watson's part. If Watson was convicted of first-degree murder and also found sane, then the jury would have to decide the ultimate question, whether he was to be given life or death. And this meant I would again face many of the same problems I had with the girls in the penalty phase of the earlier trial. Still another problem was Watson's demeanor. In an obvious attempt to project a college boy image, Watson dressed very conservatively in court, short hair, shirt and tie, blue blazer, slacks. But he still looked strange. His eyes were glassy and never seemed to focus. He reacted not at all to the damning testimony of such witnesses as Linda Kasabian, Paul Watkins, Brooks Poston, and Diane Lake. And his mouth was always slightly gaping, giving him the appearance of being mentally retarded. Taking the stand on direct examination by the defense, Tex played the part of Manson's abject slave. He admitted shooting or stabbing six of the Tate LaBianca victims, but denied stabbing Sharon Tate. And everything which showed either premeditation or deliberation, he put on Manson or the girls. My cross-examination so shook Tex that he often forgot he was supposed to be playing the idiot. By the time I'd finished, it was obvious to the jury that he was in complete command of his mental faculties, and probably always had been. I also got him to admit that he had stabbed Sharon Tate, too, that he didn't think of the victims as people but as just blobs, that he had told Dr. Joel Fort that the people at the Tate residence were running around like chickens with their heads cut off, and that when he said this he had smiled, and I tore to shreds his story that he was simply an unthinking zombie programmed by Charles Manson, as well as cast considerable doubt on his claim that he now felt remorse for what he had done. Watson's testimony cleared up some mysteries. Contrary to the findings of LAPD evidence expert Dwayne Wolfer, Watson identified the pair of red wire cutters found in Manson's dune buggy as the pair he had used to cut the Tate telephone wires that night. Also revealed for the first time were Manson's exact instructions to Watson on the night of the murders at 10,050 Cielo Drive. Watson testified, "Charlie called me over behind a car and handed me a gun and a knife. He said for me to take the gun and knife and go up to where Terry Melcher used to live. He said to kill everybody in the house as gruesome as I could. I believe he said something about movie stars living there." And Watson admitted that when he entered the LaBianca residence, he was already armed with a knife. "My greatest difficulty during the entire Watson trial came not from the evidence, the defense attorneys, or the defense witnesses, but from the judge, Adolph Alexander, who was a personal friend of defense attorney Sam Bubrick. Alexander not only repeatedly favored the defense in his rulings, he went far beyond that. During voir dire, he remarked, 'Many of us are opposed to the death penalty.' When prosecution witnesses were testifying, he gave them incredulous, unbelieving looks. When defense witnesses took the stand, he industriously took notes. All this was done right in front of the jury. He also frequently cross-examined the prosecution witnesses. Finally, I'd had it. Asking to approach the bench, I reminded Alexander that this was a jury trial, not a court trial, and that I was immensely concerned that by cross-examining the prosecution witnesses, he was giving the jury the impression that he didn't believe the witnesses. And since a judge has substantial stature in the eyes of a jury, this could be extremely harmful to the people. I suggested that if he wanted to have certain questions asked, he write them out and give them to the defense attorneys to ask." Thereafter, Alexander cut down on his cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses. However, he still continued to amaze me. When the jury went out to deliberate, he didn't even have the exhibits sent back to the jury room, a virtually automatic act, until after I had demanded that he do so. And once, in chambers and off the record, he referred to the defendant as poor Tex. Also off the record was a remark I made to him toward the end of the trial. "You're the biggest single obstacle to my obtaining a conviction of first-degree murder in this case." Despite the problems presented by Judge Alexander, on October 12, 1971, the jury found Watson guilty of 7 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of conspiracy to commit murder. That I had effectively destroyed the testimony of the defense psychiatrists on cross-examination was borne out by the fact that on October 19th, it took the jury only 2.5 hours to decide that Watson was sane. And on October 21st, after remaining out only 6 hours, they returned with a verdict of death. The trial had lasted 2.5 months and cost $250,000. It also added another 40 volumes, 5,916 pages, to the mini library on the Tate LaBianca murders. Although Judge Alexander thanked the jury for the conscientious job they had done, he remarked on the day he sentenced Watson, "If I had tried this case without a jury, I possibly would have arrived at a different verdict." In still other proceedings, Susan Atkins pleaded guilty to the murder of Gary Hinman and was given life imprisonment. In sentencing her, Judge Raymond Choate called her a danger to any community who should spend her entire life in custody. The defense obtained separate trials for Charles Manson, Bruce Davis, and Steve Grogan on the combined Hinman-Shea murder charges. Despite the fact that the body of Donald Shorty Shea hadn't been found, and hasn't to this day, prosecutors Bert Katz, Anthony Manzella, and Stephen Kay succeeded in the difficult task of obtaining guilt verdicts against each of the defendants on all of the counts. Verdicts of life imprisonment were returned for Manson and Davis. The Grogan jury voted death, but when it came time for sentencing, 2 days before Christmas 1971, Judge James Colts, commenting that Grogan was too stupid and too hopped up on drugs to decide anything on his own, and declaring that it was really Manson who decided who lived or died, reduced the sentence to life imprisonment. During voir dire in his trial, Manson, angered by the judge's refusal to let him represent himself, told the court, "I enter a plea of guilty. I chopped off Shorty's head." The judge refused to accept the plea, and the next day Manson withdrew it. During another angry outburst, Manson turned to the press and said, "I've told my people to start killing you." Again, Manson was represented by Irving Kenrick. With Irving, he knew it would be a long trial, postponing his trip to San Quentin's death row. Through all the trials, the Manson girls continued their vigil on the corner of Temple and Broadway. Literally in the shadow of the Hall of Justice, in view of the thousands of people who passed that corner every day, they fashioned a bizarre plot to free all the imprisoned Manson family members. In late July of 1971, my co-author learned from a family member in the San Francisco Bay Area that the family was planning to break out Manson sometime within the next month. Though he was not told how they intended to accomplish this, he was given some additional details. The family was stockpiling arms and ammunition. They had secretly rented a house in South Los Angeles and were hiding an escaped convict there. And with Manson's escape, Helter Skelter will really start. The revolution will be on. Wishful thinking? I wasn't sure, and passed the information along to LAPD. When I did, I learned that among the witnesses Manson had called in the Hinman Shea trial was a Folsom convict named Kenneth Como, also known by the colorful AKA Jesse James. Though it hadn't been publicized, when brought to Los Angeles less than a week before, Como had managed to escape from the Hall of Records. LAPD doubted, however, that he was still in the area. As for the Manson escape, they had heard rumors also, but nothing definite. They were inclined to doubt the tale. On schedule, less than a month later, the Manson family made their attempt. Shortly after closing time on the night of Saturday, August 21st, 1971, six armed robbers entered the Western Surplus store in the Los Angeles suburb of Hawthorne. While one kept a shotgun on the female clerk and two customers, the others began carrying rifles, shotguns, and pistols to a van parked in the alley outside. They had collected about 140 guns when they spotted the first police car. LAPD, alerted by a silent alarm, had already sealed off the alley. The robbers came out shooting. In the 10-minute gun battle that followed, the van was riddled with over 50 bullets, and some 20 bullets crashed into the black and whites. Surprisingly, no one was killed, though three of the suspects received slight wounds. All six robbers were Manson family members. Apprehended were Mary Brunner, 27, first member of the family, Catherine Scher, a.k.a. Gypsy, 29, and Dennis Rice, 32, both recently freed after serving 90-day sentences for their part in the attempted silencing of Barbara Hoyt. Lawrence Bailey, a.k.a. Larry Jones, 23, who was present the night the Tate killers left Spawn, and escaped convict Kenneth Como, 33. Another family member, Charles Lavette, 19, got away during the gunfight but was subsequently apprehended. After their arrest, it was learned that the same group was also responsible for the robbery of a Covina beer distributorship on August 13th, which netted them $2,600. The police surmised that through the robberies, the group intended to get enough guns and ammunition to stage a San Rafael-type commando raid on the courthouse. Steve Grogan had called Manson as a witness in his trial. It was believed that the day Manson appeared in court, the family intended to storm the Hall of Justice, breaking out both. Actually, the real plan was far more spectacular, and given the right circumstances and enough public pressure, it just might have worked. Although never made public before this, according to a family member who was privy to the planning of the Hawthorne robbery, the real plan was as follows. Using the stolen weapons, the family was going to hijack a 747 and kill one passenger every hour until Manson and all the other imprisoned family members were released. Extraordinary security measures were taken during the trial of the Hawthorne robbery defendants, in part because the defense had called as witnesses what Judge Arthur Alarcon labeled the biggest collection of murderers in Los Angeles County at one time. 12 convicted killers, including Manson, Beausoleil, Atkins, Krenwinkle, Van Houten, Grogan, and Davis, took the stand. Their presence in one place made everyone a little nervous, especially since by this time the family had discovered that the Hall of Justice was not escape-proof. In the early morning hours of October 20, 1971, Kenneth Como hacksawed his way through the bars of his 13th-floor cell, climbed down to the 8th floor on a rope made of bedsheets, kicked in a window in the courtroom of Department 104, where just a few months earlier I'd prosecuted Manson and his 3 female co-defendants, then left the building by way of the stairs. Sandra Good picked up Como in the family van. Though Sandy later smashed up the van and was arrested, Como managed to elude capture for 7 hours. Also arrested, but subsequently released, there being no positive proof that they had aided and abetted the escape, were Squeaky, Brenda, Kitty, and 2 other family members. No attempt was made to break out Manson during the Hawthorne trial. However, 2 of the jurors had to be replaced by alternates after receiving telephone threats that they would be killed if they voted for conviction. The calls were linked to an unidentified female family member. Although Gypsy and Rice had previously been given only 90 days for their part in the attempted murder of a prosecution witness, they and their co-defendants found that the courts take shooting at police officers a little more seriously. All were charged with 2 counts of armed robbery. Rice pleaded guilty and was sent to state prison. The others were convicted on both counts and given the following sentences. Lovett, 2 consecutive 5-year-to-life terms. Cher, 10 years to life. Como, 15 years to life. Brunner and Bailey, 20 years to life. Sandra Good was subsequently tried for aiding and abetting an escape. Her attorney, the one and only Irving Kenrick, claimed she had been kidnapped by Como. The jury didn't buy it, and Sandy was given 6 months in jail. The day Como escaped, Kenrick, appearing in Judge Raymond Choate's court, claimed in his patented way, "I allege, with no proof at this particular time, that this escape was deliberately allowed to take place." Judge Choate asked Kenrick if he could explain why Como was forced to climb down a rope from the 13th to the 8th floor. "That makes it look good, Your Honor," Kenrick explained. While Manson was still on trial for the Hinman Shea murders, I dropped into the courtroom one day. It was a welcome relief to be a spectator for a change. Manson, who had recently taken to wearing a black stormtrooper's uniform in court, spotted me and sent a message by the bailiff that he wanted to speak to me. There were a few things I wanted to ask him about also, so I stayed over after court recessed. Sitting in the prisoner's dock in the courtroom, we talked from 4:30 p.m. to nearly 6 p.m. None of the talk concerned the current charges against him. Mostly, we discussed his philosophy. I was especially interested in learning the evolution of some of his ideas and questioned him at length about his relationship with Scientology and with the satanic cult known as the Process, or the Church of the Final Judgment. Manson had wanted to speak to me, he said, because he wanted me to know, "I don't have no hard feelings." He told me that I had done a fantastic, remarkable job in convicting him, and he said, "You gave me a fair trial, like you promised." He was not bitter about the result, however, because to him, prison has always been my home. "I didn't want to leave it the last time, and you're only sending me back there." There were regular meals, not great, but better than the garbage at Spawn Ranch. And since you don't have to work if you don't want to, he'd have plenty of time to play his guitar. "That may be, Charlie, but you don't have any women there," I said. "I don't need broads," he replied, Every woman I ever had, she asked me to make love to her. I never asked them. I can do without them. There was plenty of sex in prison, he said. Although Manson again claimed that the Beatles' music and LSD were responsible for the Tate LaBianca murders, he admitted that he had known they were going to happen, because I even knew what the mice were doing at Spawn Ranch. He then added, So I said to them, Here, do you want this rope? Do you want this gun? And later I told them not to tell anyone about what happened. Though careful never to do so in open court, in our private conversations, Manson often referred to blacks as niggers. He claimed he didn't dislike them. I don't hate anyone, he said, but I know they hate me. Returning to the familiar theme of Helter Skelter, I asked him when he thought the black man was going to take over. I may have put a clog in them, he replied. You mean the trial alerted Whitey? His reply was a simple and sad, yeah. Our conversation took place on June 14, 1971. The following day, one of the attorneys complained, and Judge Choate conducted an evidentiary hearing in open court. I testified to the gist of our conversation, noting that Manson had asked to speak to me and not vice versa, and that the current charges were not discussed. There was nothing unethical about this, I observed. Moreover, I'd told Kenrick that Manson wanted to talk to me, but Kenrick had merely walked away. The bailiff, Rusty Burrell, who had sat in on the conversation, staying overtime because he found it interesting, supported my account, as did Manson himself. Manson. The version the man, indicating me, gave was right on. I am almost sure Mr. Kenrick knew that I had asked to see him. I had wanted to speak to this man for the last year, and it was my request that motivated it. As for the hearing itself, Manson said, Your Honor, I don't think this is fair at all. You know, this was my mistake. Agreeing, and ruling that there had been no impropriety involved, Judge Choate brought the hearing to an end. The irony of all this was not lost on the press, which reported with some incredulity that Manson had taken the stand to defend the man who had convicted him of 7 murders. My interest in the sources of Manson's beliefs stretched back to my assignment to the case. Some of those sources have been mentioned earlier. Others, although inadmissible as evidence in the trial, have more than a passing interest, if only as clues to the genesis of such a sick obsession. I knew, from Greg Jacobson and others, that Manson was an eclectic, a borrower of ideas. I knew, too, both from his prison records and from my conversations with him, that Manson's involvement with Scientology had been more than a passing fad. Manson told me, as he had Paul Watkins, that he had reached the highest state, Theta Clear, and no longer had any connection with or need for Scientology. I was inclined to accept at least the latter portion of his claim. In my rather extensive investigation, I found no evidence of any kind that Manson was involved with Scientology after his release from prison in 1967. By this time, he had gone on to do his own thing. One of Manson's chief disciples, Bruce Davis, was very closely involved with Scientology for a time, working in its London headquarters from about November or December of 1968 to April of 1969. According to a Scientology spokesman, Davis was kicked out of the organization for his drug use. He returned to the Manson family and Spawn Ranch in time to participate in the Hinman and Shea slayings. What effect, if any, Scientology had on Manson's mental state cannot be measured. Undoubtedly, he picked up from his auditing sessions in prison some knowledge of mind control, as well as some techniques which he later put to use in programming his followers. Manson's link with the process, or the Church of the Final Judgment, is more tenuous, yet considerably more fascinating. The leader of the satanic cult is one Robert Moore, whose cult name is Robert de Grimston. Himself a former disciple of Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard, Moore broke with Scientology about 1963 to form his own group, after apparently attaining a high position in the London headquarters. He and his followers later traveled to various parts of the world, including Mexico and the United States, and for at least several months, and possibly longer, he lived in San Francisco. He also reportedly participated in a seminar at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, though whether this coincided with any of Manson's visits there is unknown. One of de Grimston's most fervent disciples is one Victor Wilde, a young leather goods manufacturer whose process name is Brother Ely. Up until December of 1967, Victor Wilde's residence and the San Francisco headquarters for the process was 407 Cole Street in Haight-Ashbury. From about April through July 1967, Charles Manson and his still-fledgling family lived just two blocks away, at 636 Cole. In view of Manson's curiosity, it appears very likely that he at least investigated the Satanists, and there is fairly persuasive evidence that he borrowed some of their teachings. In one of our conversations during the Tate-LaBianca trial, I asked Manson if he knew Robert Moore or Robert de Grimston. He denied knowing de Grimston, but said he had met Moore. "You're looking at him," Manson told me. "Moore and I are one and the same." I took this to mean that he felt they thought alike. Not long after this, I was visited by two representatives of the process, a Father John and a Brother Matthew. Having heard that I was asking questions about the group, they had been sent from their Cambridge, Massachusetts headquarters to assure me that Manson and Moore had never met and that Moore was opposed to violence. They also left me a stack of process literature. The following day, the names Father John and Brother Matthew appeared on Manson's visitors list. What they discussed is unknown. All I know is that in my last conversation with Manson, Charlie became evasive when I questioned him about the process. In 1968 and 1969, the process launched a major recruiting drive in the United States. They were in Los Angeles in May and June of 1968, and for at least several months in the fall of 1969, returning to England in about October, after claiming to have converted some 200 American hippies to their sect. Manson was in Los Angeles during both periods. It is possible that there may have been some contact with Manson and/or his group, but I found no evidence of this. I'm inclined to think that Manson's contact with the group probably occurred in San Francisco in 1967, as indicated, at a time when his philosophy was still being formulated. I believe there was at least some contact, in view of the many parallels between Manson's teachings and those of the process, as revealed in their literature. Both preached an imminent, violent Armageddon, in which all but the chosen few would be destroyed. Both found the basis for this in the Book of Revelation. Both conceived that the motorcycle gangs, such as Hell's Angels, would be the troops of the last days, and both actively sought to solicit them to their side. The three great gods of the universe, according to the process, were Jehovah, Lucifer, and Satan, with Christ the ultimate unifier who reconciles all three. Manson had a simpler duality. He was known to his followers as both Satan and Christ. Both preached the second coming of Christ, a not unusual belief, except in their interpretation of it. According to a process pamphlet, "Through love, Christ and Satan have destroyed their enmity and come together for the end, Christ to judge, Satan to execute the judgment." When Christ returned this time, Manson said, it would be the Romans, i.e. the establishment, who went up on the cross. Manson's attitude toward fear was so curious I felt it to be almost unique. At least I felt that until reading in a special issue of The Process magazine devoted to fear. Fear is beneficial. Fear is the catalyst of action. It is the energizer, the weapon built into the game in the beginning, enabling a being to create an effect upon himself, to spur himself on to new heights and to brush aside the bitterness of failure. Though the wording differs, this is almost exactly what Manson preached. Manson spoke frequently of the bottomless pit, the process of the bottomless void. Within the organization, the process was called, at least until 1969, the family, while its members were known as brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers. The symbol of the process is similar, though not identical, to the swastika Manson carved on his forehead. Among the precepts of the process which parallel Manson's own, the time of the end is now. The ultimate sin is to kill an animal. Christ said, love your enemy. Christ's enemy was Satan. Love Christ and Satan. The lamb and the goat must come together. Pure love descended from the pinnacle of heaven, united with pure hatred raised from the depths of hell. One former process member, being interrogated by LAPD in connection with two motorcycle gang slayings, neither of which was connected with the process, said of the cult, they don't like anybody that they can't indoctrinate or anybody that is not with them. They are just totally against what they call the gray forces, the rich establishment or the Negroes. Question. Why don't they like Negroes? Answer. I don't know. They just don't. Question. They have a natural hate for the Negro? Answer. They have a natural hate, but they would also like to use the Negro as a whole to begin some kind of militant thing. They are really good at picking out angry people. This was merely the opinion of one disaffiliated member, and may well not be the official position of the process itself, but the similarities to Manson's own philosophy are still chilling. These are only some of the parallels I found. They are enough to convince me, at least, that even if Manson himself may never have been a member of the process, he borrowed heavily from the satanic cult. There is at least one precept Manson did not borrow from the group. Unmarried adherents are expected to remain chaste. Nor are these the only connections between the Manson family and Satanists. Bobby Beausoleil was for a time closely associated with filmmaker Kenneth Anger, who was himself deeply involved in both the motorcycle gang Mystique and the occult. Beausoleil starred in Anger's film Lucifer Rising, playing the part of Lucifer. This was before he ever met Manson. In his psychiatric report on Susan Atkins, Dr. Joel Hochman wrote of a portion of her San Francisco period, apparently sometime in 1967 or 1968, before she too met Manson. At this time, she entered into what she now calls her satanic period. She became involved with Anton LaVey, the Satanist. LaVey, founder of the San Francisco-based First Church of Satan, is known by those knowledgeable in such matters more as a spectacular showman than as a demonic Satanist. He has stated numerous times that he condemns violence and ritual sacrifice. She took a part in a commercial production of a witch's Sabbath and recalls the opening night when she took LSD. She was supposed to lie down in a coffin during the act and lay down in it while hallucinating. She stated that she didn't want to come out, and consequently the curtain was 15 minutes late. She stated that she felt alive and everything else in the ugly world was dead. Subsequently, she stayed on her satanic trip for approximately 8 months. During the Tate-LaBianca trial, Patricia Krenwinkle doodled. Her two favorite subjects, according to bailiff Bill Murray, were devil's heads and the Mendes goat, both Satanist symbols. Before he killed him, Charles Tex Watson told Wojtek Frykowski, "I am the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." An apparently important influence on Manson in both precept and example was a dead man, Adolf Hitler. Manson looked up to Hitler and spoke of him often. He told his followers that Hitler had the best answer to everything, and that he was a tuned-in guy who leveled the karma of the Jews. Manson saw himself as no less a historical figure, a leader who would not only reverse the karma of the blacks, but level all but his own Aryan race, his all-white, all-American family. There were both surface and substantive parallels between Hitler and Manson. Both were vegetarians, Both were little men. Both suffered deep wounds in their youth, the psychological scars at least contributing to, if not causing, their deep hatred for society. Both suffered the stigma of illegitimacy, in Manson's case because he himself was a bastard, in Hitler's because his father was. Both were vagrant wanderers. Both were frustrated and rejected artists. Both liked animals more than people. Both were deeply engrossed in the occult. Both had others commit their murders for them. Both were racists. Yet there is some evidence that both also believed they carried the blood of the very people they despised. Many historians believe that Hitler was secretly obsessed with the fear that he had a Jewish ancestor. If Manson's prison records are correct, he may have believed his father was black. Both surrounded themselves with bootlicking slaves. Both sought out the weaknesses of others and used them. Both programmed their followers through repetition, repeating the same phrases over and over. Both realized and exploited the psychological impact of fear. Both had a favorite epithet for those they hated. Hitler's was Schweinhund. Manson's was pigs. Both had eyes which their followers described as hypnotic. Beyond that, however, both had a presence, a charisma, and a tremendous amount of personal persuasive power. Generals went to Hitler intent on convincing him that his military plans were insane. They left true believers. Dean Morehouse went to Spahn Ranch to kill Manson for stealing his daughter, Ruth Ann. He ended up on his knees worshiping him. Both had an incredible ability to influence others. Both Manson's and Hitler's followers were able to explain away the monstrous acts their leaders committed by retreating into philosophical abstractions. Probably the single most important influence on Hitler was Nietzsche. Manson told Jacobson that he had read Nietzsche. Whether true or not, Manson read with difficulty, and Nietzsche is not easy reading. Both Manson and Hitler believed in the three basic tenets of Nietzsche's philosophy. Women are inferior to men. The white race is superior to all other races. It is not wrong to kill if the end is right. And kill, they both did. Both believed that mass murder was all right, even desirable if it furthered the attainment of some grand plan. Each had such a plan. Each had his own grandiose obsession. Hitler's was the Third Reich. Manson's was Helter Skelter. At some point, parallels become more than coincidence. How much of this was conscious borrowing on Manson's part, how much unconscious emulation is unknown. I do believe that if Manson had had the opportunity, he would have become another Hitler. I can't conceive of his stopping short of murdering huge masses of people. Some mysteries remain. One is the exact number of murders committed by members of the Manson family. Manson bragged to Juan Flynn that he had committed 35 murders. When Juan first told me this, I was inclined to doubt that it was anything more than sick boasting on Charlie's part. There is now evidence, however, that even if this wasn't true then, the total to date may be very close to and may even exceed Manson's estimate. In November 1969, Susan Atkins told Ronnie Howard, "There are 11 murders that they will never solve." Leslie Van Houten used the same number in her interrogation by Mike McGann, while Uish told Barbara Hoyt that she knew of 10 people the family had killed, besides Sharon. Susan told Virginia Graham that, in addition to the 8 Hinman Tate LaBianca slayings, there's more, and more before. One was undoubtedly Shay. Another was probably the Black Panther, Bernard Crowe, whom Susan, like Manson himself, erroneously believed dead. Susan may have been referring to Crowe when, in the tape she made with Caballero, she said that the .22-caliber Longhorn revolver used in the Tate homicides had been used in other killings, though on the tape this was clearly plural, not singular. Susan also told Virginia, "There's also 3 people out in the desert that they done in." According to Virginia, Susan just said it very nonchalant-like, mentioning no names. When Steve Zabriskie tried unsuccessfully to convince Portland police that a Charlie and a Clem were involved in both the Tate and the LaBianca murders, he also said that Ed Bailey had told him that he had seen this Charlie shoot a man in the head. The murder had occurred in Death Valley, according to Bailey, and the gun was a .45 caliber automatic. When interrogated by LAPD in May 1970, Bailey, true name Edward Arthur Bailey, denied this. However, another source, who was for a time close to the family, claims he heard there are supposed to be two boys and a girl buried about 8 feet deep behind Barker Ranch. No bodies have ever been found. But then the body of Donald Shorty Shea has never been found either. On October 13, 1968, two women, Clyda Delaney and Nancy Warren, were beaten, then strangled to death with leather thongs a few miles south of Ukiah, California. Several members of the Manson family were in the area at the time. 2 days later, Manson suddenly moved the whole family from Spahn to Barker Ranch. The Mendocino County Sheriff's Office believed there might be a link, but a belief is not evidence. At about 3:30 a.m. on December 30, 1968, 17-year-old Marina Haba, daughter of writer Hans Haba, was abducted outside the West Hollywood home of her mother as she was returning home from a date. Her body was found on New Year's Day off Mulholland near Beaumont Drive. Cause of death, multiple stab wounds in the neck and chest. It has been rumored but never confirmed that the victim was acquainted with one or more members of the family. Though most of his followers were at Barker Ranch, Manson was apparently in Los Angeles on December 30th, returning to Barker the following day. Though several persons, including KNXT newscaster Carl George, believed there was a connection, nothing definite has been established, and the murder remains unsolved. On the night of May 27, 1969, Darwin Oral Scott was hacked to death in his Ashland, Kentucky apartment. The killing was so savage that the victim, who was stabbed 19 times, was pinned to the floor with a butcher knife. 64-year-old Darwin Scott was the brother of Colonel Scott, the man alleged to be Charles Manson's father. In the spring of 1969, a motorcycle riding guru from California who called himself Preacher appeared in the Ashland area with several female followers. Dispensing free LSD to local teenagers, he attempted to set up a commune in an abandoned farmhouse near Huntington. He remained in the area until April, at which time vigilantes burned down the house and drove off the group because, quoting the Ashland paper, they didn't like hippies and didn't want any more around. At least four local residents later told reporters that Manson and Preacher were one and the same person. Despite their positive IDs, Manson's presence in California during at least part of this period is fairly well documented, and it would appear that he was in California on the day of Scott's murder. On May 22, 1969, Manson telephoned his parole officer, Samuel Barrett, requesting permission to travel to Texas with the Beach Boys. Permission was withheld pending verification of Manson's employment with the group. In a letter dated May 27th, the same day as Scott's murder, Manson said that the group had left without him and that he had moved from Death Valley back to Spahn Ranch. To categorize Barrett's control over Manson as minimal would be an exaggeration. Barrett did not again talk to Manson until June 18th. Barrett did not note the postmark on the letter. He did note that he didn't receive it until June 3rd, 7 days after it was supposedly written. It is possible that Manson was using the letter as an alibi. It is also possible that he sent one of his killers to murder Scott. But both possibilities are strictly conjecture. The murder of Darwin Scott also remains unsolved. Early on the morning of July 17, 1969, 16-year-old Mark Waltz left his parents' home in Chatsworth and hitchhiked to the Santa Monica Pier to go fishing. His pole was later found on the pier. His body was found about 4 a.m. on July 18th off Topanga Canyon Boulevard, a short distance from Mulholland. Young Walt's face and head were badly bruised, and he had been shot 3 times in the chest by a .22-caliber weapon. Though neither a ranch hand nor a family member, Walt's occasionally hung around Spawn Ranch. Although LASO sent investigators to Spawn, they were unable to uncover any evidence linking the killing to anyone there. Walt's brother, however, called the ranch and told Manson